Good evening, this is Mark Lynch, and this is Inquiry. My guest tonight is Phuc Tran, writer, high school Latin teacher, much sought after tattoo artist, and we're talking about his book, Sai Gon, a misfits memoir of great books, punk rock, and the fight to fit in. Phuc, welcome to the show. It's a real pleasure to talk to you. I love this memoir.
Oh, Mark, thanks so much for having me on.
This memoir does a lot of different things, and we'll talk about each in its turn. But the great thing I love is that every chapter title is the title of a famous book, and literature really has figured so prominently for you in your life, and it's actually got you through high school.
Yeah, I mean, I don't think that I'm the first kid.
Yeah, but there's not a lot of them out there.
Yeah, and you know, I mean, I just think that I really wanted to connect with my community, or you know, with somebody, you know, and you know, find a you know someone whose alienation resonated with mine, and I found that in Hester Prynne, you know, and Nathaniel Hawthorne.
Man, now you were born in Vietnam, immigrated to the United States, eventually to Carlisle High School, Carlisle, Pennsylvania, which I cannot imagine the culture shock that must have been like.
Yeah, and it was really more of a shock for my parents.
I felt for your parents in some ways.
Yeah, I came here when I was two, you know, not even two. So, you know, at least as far as I knew, I was, you know, fully American until I realized that my parents, you know, weren't, and my family wasn't like, you know, our community, you know, and then people started treating us like we didn't belong. And that's when you realize you're like, oh, there's something else going on here. But, you know, so there's, you know, there are these gaps, like these fissures, you know, there's the ones at home between my, you know, myself and my parents as I'm fully Americanizing and my parents are doing that more slowly. And then my community, you know, which, you know, will always see us as foreign, you know, no matter how well read we are or how well spoken we are.
Well, it's always worried me, the sort of virulent racism against people who are from Vietnam. Obviously, it has something to do with our involvement in the war there. But you were a subject of a lot of classic sort of redneck racism.
I was. And as I've gotten older, I'm more curious about it. You know, I'm obviously, when I was a teenager, you know, like I was so angry about it and so resentful. And now I'm so curious, you know, especially in this political climate. I'm so curious about that other side, you know, because there is a humanity there and I want to know what it is, because it's the thing that, you know, people didn't take the time to be curious about with me. And I feel like if I just paint, you know, the proverbial other side, you know, as, you know, these sort of two-dimensional monsters, like that doesn't do our democracy any service, you know. So I'm more curious, and I hope that the book is just an invitation for all of us to be curious about each other, to hear each other's stories.
And I think it accomplishes that. But still, as a young teenager, this kind of attitude by the people who are around you at school, and this is a quote from your book, be less Asian, be bullied less. And that led you to make some really strange choices.
Sure, yeah. I mean, so I just discovered, really the saving grace for me was in middle school when I discovered like the skateboard punk rock culture, you know, that was sort of like that, you know, island of misfit toys, you know, where all the kids who were drawn to it were just like, you know, yeah, we don't fit into our family either. And that was such a balm for me, you know, to know that like there were these, you know, suburban white kids who felt just as alienated as I did. And that just, yeah, that was so heartening for me to know that like they didn't have easy street either, you know. And it's just all band together.
It's amazing because I taught that age group at that time at the Worcester Art Museum here. And it's funny how many of them sort of gravitated towards the alternative music scene, the dress, the skateboarding and everything else. And I do want to mention you have impeccable alternative music tastes.
Thank you. You know, I mean, and you know, you listen, I mean, now it's like with the, you know, I'm not complaining about the internet. Like, I don't want to be the guy who's like, oh, the internet ruined everything. But I mean, you know, like in the 80s, like, you know, there wasn't that much music that was speaking so directly about, you know, disaffection and alienation and just you know, unhappiness, you know, of whatever kind, right? I mean, you had like the Smiths sort of talking about like sort of internal or personal sort of misery, self-inflicted misery. But then you also had like more politicized stuff, you know, like, you know, the Minor Threat and like, you know, Agent Orange and Social Distortion, you know, where they're talking about like social and political issues, you know, and so it was really powerful for me to hear music that was super profane, right? Like just all the dirty words you could imagine, but also talking about really important political things. Yeah.
In preparation for just talking, I literally just listened to How Soon Is Now. Now that's and I want to get back to that in a little bit, but the other, one of the other sub stories here is your very complicated relationship with your parents. And, and that at times that was really tough to read about.
Yeah, I mean, you know, my parents are, you know, like, again, as I'm older and I've had the chance to, you know, spend lots of money on a therapist, you know, it's like I recognize all the things that they went through. And, you know, and I wanted to, you know, do that. I wanted to depict that in as honest, you know, and urgent and sort of emotionally real way as possible. You know, I felt like I wasn't going to do my readers or myself, you know, any service by sort of soft peddling it. And so, yeah, I mean, there's domestic violence and there's abuse. And I really wanted to sort of, you know, name that head on. And also, like, I think it's been amazing to have readers, you know, reach out to me.
Right. I can see that
happening.
Thank me.
Yep. Yeah, to thank me for being so, you know, so candid. Yeah.
Are your parents still alive?
They are. Yeah. They live in Orange County, California.
Have they read the book?
They claim not to have. You know, my brother has pressed them. You know, my brother and I are very close.
Yeah,
and,
that comes out in the book. Yeah.
Yeah. And so he's asked them a few times. You know, my mother is functionally illiterate, so I just don't think that she could make her way through it. You know, my father could read it. I don't know if he has. And frankly, like, I think the complexity with which I tell their story, I think, would be lost on him. So, but I'll keep you posted if I hear from them.
Well, I could imagine it has to be really tough because, I mean, your father was physically violent. At one point, he abandoned you and your brother on the side of a road.
Yeah, just me. Yeah.
Just you.
And there was another time where they pretended to leave the house, right?
That's right. And you had to make your brother some food and stuff like that. But I mean, we can laugh about it now, but I'll tell you, within the context of the book, that was pretty shocking. And it's like, you're right. It helps people. I've been through stuff like that when I was growing up. Maybe not to that level, but I had parents that were definitely not, they shouldn't have been parents. It was tough to read about, but you came through the whole mess seemingly unscathed. Is that just?
Well, I wouldn't say that's very kind of you to say.
Okay, at least you're able to put on a great face about it. But I mean,
for sure.
As you say, you mentioned, I can imagine some kind of therapy has to have been involved in that.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I think I think it's critical for everyone, right? I mean, I think, you know, there's, you know, and I don't want to get into sort of like that, you know, sort of, you know, the trauma Olympics of like who had it worse and like
right,
who got
right.
more. But I think it's important for all of us to, you know, sort of check in. And like, I think mental health, I think we, you know, it's less stigmatized than it used to be. But I think it just needs to be part of everybody's, you know, sort of annual routine, like a physical or something, you know, just also check in with your therapist. And
but for how long did it take you to work out of this? You really had an anti-Vietnam or Vietnamese stint there going on for a while because you didn't want to be associated with the cultural heritage.
Yeah. And I recognize that was really just, and those weren't internal pressures. You know, those were pressures that were on me, you know, that were sort of created by, you know, my environment and, you know, sort of like a larger society that didn't value it, you know, that. You know, and for me, like, once I sorted that out, that I realized, like, oh, like, it has nothing to do with my own shame. Or, I mean, obviously, I internalized some of it. But once I realized that it wasn't sort of self-generated and that it really was just about how people treated me, and that once I recognized I couldn't control how people saw me, I really made peace with it. And, you know, it's neither a source of shame nor a source of strength for me. You know, like, I think it's an incidental thing. You know, frankly, like, I'm more excited to talk to someone about, like, you know, My Bloody Valentine or, you know, The Smiths, and then I am about, like, you know, great Vietnamese food. I mean, I love Vietnamese food and I love Vietnam, but, you know, I just, it's not something I geek out over. And for some reason, like, I think like that shared connection of like great music or great books for me is more resonant. But yeah.
You actually at one point tried to change your name to Peter, as in Peter Parker.
Oh yeah. Oh boy.
Oh my God.
So ill-fated. And I thought it was.
And first of all, what a great character to pick, the outcast teenage superhero.
Yeah, no, I know. I mean, it's really like I think about this, and when I read those comic books, especially like the Marvel, right?
Oh yeah, it's perfect. Marvel, it's
like,
perfect.
About, like, it's like it's all about like disaffected teenagers, and you know, unlike DC, and that was so powerful. And I was like, oh yeah, I'm Peter Parker, and so I picked Peter, and then you know, I realized that Peter is also a slang term for genitalia.
Yep.
So I backtracked very quickly.
Jesus, there's a really startling section. When you read Xavier Hollander, you read the Happy Hooker, which is, first of all, is a classic teenage experience to like steal a book like that and start to like get all horny about it. But then and people may not remember this, in the middle of the book, it becomes incredibly racist about Asian men.
Oh my God. I mean, about everybody, right? Like,
right.
Just Asian people that, you know, and for it to be sort of your first, you know, sort of, you know, quote unquote sexual experience, or experience with porn is not a sexual, I mean, it, you know, but your first experience with porn, and to have it be laced with all of this like racism and like, you know, prejudice, it was unreal. I was like, wait a second, you know, and I'm reading this, it's a published book, that it's this, her job is to have sex. And I just sort of thought, is there something to this? You know, even then I just didn't want to believe it. I mean, it was just so, you know, characterized. It was like caricatures of all these people.
But at that same time, and you talk about this in the book, there were sort of racist characters, characterizations. You talk about Data in the Goonies, which is a classic.
Yeah.
The Temple of Doom, Gremlins, and your quote was, the movies were doing the work of America, ghettoizing us in our own minds. And when you saw those at your age, what did you think when you watched movies like Goonies and that character Data? Because even not being Asian, I watched that character at that time, and it made me cringe.
Yeah, same. And for me, I both cringed and was happy that there was at least an Asian kid.
Yeah,
Jesus. You know,
so, I mean, that's a horrible choice to have to be.
Yeah, I know. It was really so much cognitive dissonance. You know, it's like, all right, we made it. Oh no, he's like totally doesn't sound like me or look like me, or he's not doing anything cool, and he's not the hero. I mean, you know, it was. You took what you could get. Yeah, it was the 80s, you know, but we've come maybe a long way or a little bit of a way.
Now, there's some really interesting things in how you got into reading, and you read voraciously. What was Clifton Fadiman's The Lifetime Reading Plan?
Yeah, no.
I've never heard of that book. Now I feel like compelled I need to go look at it. What was that?
So in the late 60s, so Clifton Fadiman was sort of like this general kind of public intellectual. Like, he was on like TV, like the Dick Cavett Show and stuff like that. And he was a professor, and he, you know, compiled this list of like 107 books that he thought any well-read American should read to be part of like the cultural, you know, sort of academic conversation. And, you know, it starts with like Homer or like the Bible, I think, and it ends with like Solzhenitsyn. And so I found it for 50 cents at my local library, you know, in like a discard bin. And so I picked it up and I thought, oh, you know, and I read the introduction, and the introduction was like so, I mean, punk rock. Like, it was literally, you know, Clifton Fadiman basically said, you know, this is what you need to be, read to be an American. And if you disagree with me, like, you can just go screw yourself. I mean, not my words, not his, you know, but it was really very defiant and clear. And I was just hooked.
It's amazing to read it because you write about it as if it's no big thing, but you really became like the intellectual person in your high school.
Sure. Yeah. I mean,
now don't minimize it. Don't minimize it.
I just want to clarify, like I started doing it because I just wanted to look smart. Right. Like, I didn't actually read these books because, you know, for the love of like Faulkner or Joyce, like I wanted just to be able to name drop them. But I think I certainly did read a lot. And then along the way, I was like, oh, I think I like, you know.
Well, you actually had opinions that you could back up.
Yeah, for sure. It wasn't a great way to, to enter literature, but I certainly discovered great literature and great reading that way.
What was the reaction of your English teachers?
I think they just didn't know what to make. I think they were excited. Like, any book that a teacher recommended to me, I read.
That's right.
You know, without fail. And I think they were just so thrilled that here is this precocious, you know, kind of like a-hole kid who would read whatever they told him to read and then come back and have an opinion. And maybe it was like, you know, a wackadoo opinion, but maybe, you know, he also had an interesting, you know, interesting questions, or he would ask, what else should I read? Or I really liked Kafka. What else should I read? You know, I really liked Ibsen, you know, like, should I read Chekhov as well? And, you know, they were just thrilled by it and just didn't know, you know, and I just had a library card. I mean, I had all the free books you could possibly want to read.
You're listening to WISN 90.5 FM. This is Inquiry. My name is Mark Lynch. My guest tonight is Phuc Tran, writer, high school Latin teacher. I'm going to talk about that in a little bit. And sought after tattoo artist. And we're talking about his book, Saigon, a misfit's memoir of great books, punk rock, and the fight to fit in. There comes a point in this book, we were just talking about this off mic, where literally I started sweating. And that's when you had to sell your comic collection.
Me too. Oh boy, that was a bad.
I'm amazed you did it. I can't believe you did it.
Yeah, I mean, it was, you know, I was making this transition from being sort of like a comic nerd to being like a punk rock skateboard kid. And I wanted to have records and, you know, cassettes. And, you know, my family was incredibly poor. And so, I had for, 6 years been, buying comics at, 65 cents a pop. But I had hundreds of them. And little did I know, they had, increased in value, some of them.
So, I was
like,
oh, no.
My first lesson in, sort of buy low, sell high, right? So I sold all those comic books, not for as much money as I would have liked, but still I sold them and bought records with them, going into ninth grade,
I love it. I'm hurt by it, and I love it at the same time because it's two of my real interests. Have you ever gone back and actually looked at how much some of those comics would be worth now?
No, that would really, give me an aneurysm, I think, if I did that.
So here, as all this is going on, also all the typical teenage stuff is going on, like your first kiss with Charlotte, which we can't do too many details on the air. People have to read that.
That's an FCC fine just waiting to happen.
Oh, my God. Well, you were like ambushed, man. You had no idea what to make out of it.
No, I did not. I didn't know. And again, I think I think I really wanted to take, my teenage years seriously. Cause I think culturally we discount kids and teenagers all too often. And I think if we're kind with ourselves, when you're a kid, having the wrong shirt or having the wrong brand of, sneakers, it really does ruin your day. Right. And as an adult, you hear your kids and you're like, come on, right. When I was your age, da, 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 da. It really is the whole world. And so when I wrote it, I really wanted to be serious and to remind everybody that, your childhood is a real thing. And the triumphs and the, disasters are also, writ large and real.
It's amazing how the music and the literature interact. We've already established you were a huge Smiths fan, and that led to a real interest in Oscar Wilde and a real desire to go see the importance of being earnest.
Yeah, I would talk to anybody who would listen about how much I loved Oscar Wilde. I don't know where it came from, but as soon as I latched on, I think it comes from being a comic collector and a record nerd. Like you always go for, you buy the whole series if you like London Calling, then you have to go and buy, Sandinista, and then you go to buy the first album, and then it's just sort of like this deep dive mentality, which I think kids have nowadays too, but now you just have the internet, so it happens in 5 minutes instead of 2 years. But so I read everything by Oscar Wilde. I read Richard Ellman's biography of Oscar Wilde, and then my English teacher just decided that you know, there was this local performance of Importance of Being Earnest, and so she took me to it. And I didn't have a car. I had no way of going, but I think she just recognized that, you know, if I don't take this kid who's obsessed with Oscar Wilde to the play, you know, like, it's, what am I doing as an educator?
But, you know, can you imagine that happening today? No.
No, no. And I think it's a loss, right? I mean, I think, like, for teachers to be able to make a real personal connection with kids, and it is a loss, I think. Yeah.
You were at one point grounded for 6 months.
Yeah.
What did you do?
Oh man. Gosh. Well, so I was drinking with a buddy of mine, and we were driving around. I mean, it was small town Pennsylvania in the 80s, so we were drinking beers and driving around in his parents' car, and we got pulled over and arrested. Yeah, and then my parents came. I was in ninth grade. No, 10th grade. 10th grade, yeah. And my parents came and picked us up, and then I got grounded for 6 months.
Yeah. The punishment fits the crime.
Yeah, absolutely. And you know what? I was, you know, thank God for 70s architecture. It was a ranch house. So I just snuck out of my bedroom. You know, I would just tell my parents that I was turning in. I mean, I would be like, oh, it's Friday night. I'm super tired. I'm going to go to bed. And then I would lock my door and then just crawl out my window. It was just, you know, and my parents, you know, I mean, again, part of that cultural gap is like they had no idea how to raise an American teenager, you know, and so, you know, maybe I was better off for it. I'm not sure. But yeah.
In 1990, you end up reading the autobiography of Malcolm X. And your take on that book by Alex Haley, your take on that book I found really interesting. Talk to me about the autobiography, what it meant to you at that time.
Yeah, I it was recommended to me. So I had a Malcolm X T-shirt, right? I mean, like, I think much of like my discovery of Oscar Wilde, you know, my discovery of Malcolm X was through a T-shirt that I had. And my history teacher at the time said, oh, have you read, you know, his autobiography, you know, and I said, what? And so, of course, you know, I picked up that gauntlet and read the autobiography. And, you know, it was the first time that I realized that so much of the racism that my family had experienced, that I had experienced, was part of this larger, you know, racialized problem in America.
Yep.
You know, like that leading up to that point, I just figured that all the bigotry that we had experienced was personal or cultural animus related specifically to the Vietnam War, you know, and so I just thought, well, you know, like, you know, what can I do? And, you know, I had never connected, you know, the things that I had experienced with, you know, a larger racial problem in the civil rights struggle. And also, like, how did I even articulate where, you know, Asian and or Vietnamese people fit into what seemed to me like a specifically a black and white problem, right? Literally a black and white problem. So, yeah, so that was, I mean, I still am not sure. I mean, and I am an ally, and I, you know, but it, even now, like, I think there's conversations within the Asian community about, like, you know, what does our allyship look like, and you know, especially when it's just complicated. And that really helped me sort of start to unpack that complexity.
So you went to Bard, you were chosen to be the graduation speaker. Now, I got to ask you, this is not in the book, so you're a Latin teacher now. Which, having read the book, that somehow makes perfect sense. Because only a nerd would be a Latin teacher.
Yeah. Yeah.
But I'm glad you are. I'm glad there's still Latin teachers.
Oh, yeah. Going strong. Yeah.
Talk to me about that choice, because I think that's really interesting.
Yeah. I mean, I literally went off to Bard to double major in art and English. And then after the first semester, I just was really, it just wasn't what I thought it would be. You know, I think in no fault is it Bard, you know, is it a Bard thing? Like, I think I was just so unhappy in Carlisle and with my high school experience that I'd built up college to be just too much, right? It was just like, it couldn't possibly live up to everything that I hoped that it would be. And so, like, I think that disappointment was so strong. And I thought it was like, is it my major? You know, is it school? You know, like I was 18. I didn't, you know, how could you articulate like all those things? And so I dropped both of those majors and I was kind of just, you know, flailing about. And then one day I heard a kid say, oh, you know, I'm taking ancient Greek. It's the hardest thing I've ever done. And my ears like immediately perked up.
Oh my God.
I think I have like oppositional defiance disorder or something. I don't know. I heard, you know, I mean, it was, I'm sure like, it was like certain.
Well, I can just like, see you going, well, that's for me.
Exactly, exactly. So I immediately signed up for Ancient Greek. It was crushing, but like so invigorating. It was like the most fun I ever had. And so I immediately signed up for Sanskrit. I heard
that. Oh my God! Oh my God!
I'm kind of a masochist, I guess. I don't know.
So wait a minute, we still haven't gotten to Latin.
Yeah.
So of the first of all, of the three, that's the easiest.
Yeah, and it's the last one I learned. Yeah.
So did you? I mean, talk to me about the teaching part though, because that's a calling. That's a different level of thing, other than just enjoying Latin. And being able to read it, to be able to teach it, especially where there's so much opposition to it culturally.
I mean, I always knew that I wanted to teach. You know, I mean, even when I was, you know, going to major in English, I always knew that I wanted to be in a classroom, you know. And, you know, and in part it was really, you know, thinking about my own teachers, right, and just sort of the profound and incredible impact that they had on me. And I just thought, if I could have that effect on one kid, you know, you know, in a teaching career, it would be well worth it. And so I knew I was going to teach. I just didn't know what. And so it just happened to be Latin. And it's, you know, it's made sort of a comeback, but it's certainly niche, right? I mean, it's no more niche than like, you know, 80s alternative music and comic books, right?
Don't use the word niche for that, please. that just hurts me. But I mean, are students still interested in Latin? In other words, do you still get classes and people feel like they've learned something that's still important to them?
I think so. I mean, I absolutely think so. I think it's so critical, you know, in any subject that you teach, right? That you love it. You love the thing that you teach and that you love working with kids, you know, like I think if those are the sort of the shoes and the, you know, your pedagogical, you know, pair, I think you're going to do great, right? Like, just love the thing you do and love working with kids. I think everything else works itself out.
Well, we'll stop the interview there. My guest tonight has been Phuc Tran, writer, high school Latin teacher, amazing, sought after tattoo artist, and we didn't even get to talk about that. And we're talking about his book, and I think this is one of the great memoirs of the teenage life, Saigon, a misfit's memoir of great books, punk rock, and the fight to fit in. Phuc, it's been a real real joy talking to you.
Oh, thanks.
And man, I really love this book, though, on so many levels. You're listening to WICN 90.5 FM. This is Inquiry. My name is Mark Lynch. Good night.